Welcome back on the show, Marcus Philly. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Felix. I'm happy to be back.
I mean, last time we talked a lot about your company, Functional Bodybuilding, and you touched on a little bit about the training philosophy and the difference between functional bodybuilding and the sport of CrossFit. And today, I feel like we should talk a little bit more about the training and maybe the whole lifestyle and nutrition approach, since I got a lot of feedback from my community that they are more into the training thing and they don't really care about the business stuff. That's what I cared about. And they wanted to hear some training and nutrition and lifestyle insights from you. So I think today is a good opportunity to do that.
Today is a great opportunity to do that. You lead the way. Tell me what the people want to know, and I will do my best to provide concise answers so that they can get benefit from it.
Sure. I mean, although I think most of the people in the realm of CrossFit and fitness, they know about what you do and functional bodybuilding as a training methodology. But for the people who have probably not heard about you, can you maybe give them like a 2-minute intro on what functional bodybuilding is?
Since I was very young, I have been deeply curious about health and fitness, and I have gone out of my way to just acquire information, gather as much information, implement techniques and strategies and lessons upon myself to learn. Then over the years, I started to do that with clients. And so in a way, I gather information, organize it in my brain based upon personal experience and coaching experience, and then do my best to teach people. And I was influenced very heavily from basically the age of like 16 until I was 24 in kind of bodybuilding, strength and conditioning communities. And then from 24 until I was 32, heavily influenced by the CrossFit movement and the CrossFit methodology. And then around 32, I started to transition away from being in the competitive scene of CrossFit and coaching CrossFit at a CrossFit gym, and realized I wanted to train my body a little bit differently and kind of take a hybrid of everything I'd learned in my 20 years of training experience, which included bodybuilding, it included strength, traditional strength and conditioning. Obviously included a heavy influence of CrossFit. And so when I started to bring those principles together, I coined the training methods and approach functional bodybuilding. And now it's pretty commonplace to see people taking elements of CrossFit, elements of bodybuilding, putting them together in training methodologies. And I think when I started doing that in 2016, 2017, it was still pretty new. It certainly was new to the CrossFit audience. And so today, functional bodybuilding is a place where I'm sharing the information that I've learned and gathered over now more than two decades of elite level training, coaching, you know, and then just pure lifestyle training and fitness, health and fitness methods for the average everyday person. And we call it functional bodybuilding now as a business.
So over the years, you've had a lot of experience as a professional athlete on the one side, as a coach on the other side. And now with functional bodybuilding, you have the opportunity to reach even a bigger audience. What would you say are some of the fundamental training principles most people overlook or misunderstand? Because when I talk to the people who would work out in my CrossFit box, I always tell them training doesn't have to be difficult. You just have to follow some rules and then you will make progress. And that's when I look at your content on Instagram, that's probably the same things you tell your audience over and over again, that there are some principles, when you follow them, you will get great results. But what would you say are like the most common things?
I think what I've come to appreciate is that what I did as a high level athlete was not what people need in their day-to-day life. Instead, you know, what people need in their day-to-day life is consistency of movement, which I think is hard enough in and of itself for people to do. How do I make a daily practice of movement? How do I make a 3 to 4 time a week practice of moving intensely or training intensely, or with some purpose, some desired outcome where I'm going to come in and change my body? This is the hardest part, is developing that. and what it takes to actually get people results is less than what I believe they think is required, but it doesn't make the act of doing, you know, consistent fitness easy by any means. So, you know, if everybody were to walk 10,000 steps a day as their base level of movement, that would be highly effective and probably sufficient for most people's just base level of daily activity. On top of that, if they spent 4 days per week where they dedicated 60 minutes to move it, to going into a gym or some environment where they can train, and training is different than movement. Training is defined as like a, you know, a sequence of repeatable and purposeful actions that you take on your body to put yourself in an uncomfortable state, to challenge your physiology to do something it is not comfortable doing, so that after the event, after the training, your body adapts in a positive way. It develops more muscle tissue. It improves mitochondrial density in your tissues. It improves aerobic capacity. It improves something that objectively makes you more fit or improves your fitness. Now that's really what we're chasing. And that's what it's like, what is the simplest way to get people to do that is what I and many other health and fitness professionals are now focused on, rather than saying this is the fanciest, most complicated way to get the exceptional 99% results. No, here is a much more fundamental, you know, approach to checking the boxes that you need to feel good, live a long and healthful life, and, you know, maybe get some of those additional benefits of, you know, looking like really great in a bathing suit or something like that.
So get people moving on the one hand is very difficult, and especially in the realm of CrossFit, we have a lot of people who like to move but tend to move too much and work out too much, especially after like 1 or 2 years when they feel like, oh, okay, now I've mastered all the movements. Now I can train like 5 or 6 days a week, maybe 2 times a day. And then they're starting to fall apart and they maybe get injured or they lose interest in training because they don't really get what they want to achieve with their training, what they thought in the beginning might be the thing that they wanted. How do you find balance in your own training, and what aspect or what importance does recovery play, and how do you coach people to recover their body and not work out like 10 times and don't recover at all? So what is your secret here?
I think the fundamental philosophical position or stance that I take on this, and what most people don't understand, some people do understand it and they still kind of fall victim to some of the pitfalls of this philosophy, is it comes down to you either want to be an athlete and you train like an athlete, or you don't. And athletics in the pursuit of like high level athleticism is not a healthy pursuit. And I know that that's just introduces like a whole nuanced, you know, definition and question, and maybe subjective question, like what is healthy actually mean? But I'll break it down. When you try and pursue athletics and sport at the highest level, you are sacrificing something about your health in exchange for optimal performance so that you can achieve points and significance and recognition and maybe monetary compensation. So somebody who's like, you know, for Americans listening, or perhaps it's, you know, Europeans listening, you know, I like to use the NFL or American football example because it's such a famous popular sport in America, but it's also such a physically demanding sport. You know, they play 16 games, I think, a year, one every Sunday. And that Sunday event is like a full-on battle. And the athletes that are playing, they come out and they are just beat down and broken, and they're doing everything imaginable to try and get ready for the next Sunday where they can go out and give an elite level of performance. And these are, you know, men that weigh anywhere from 200 to 350 pounds, running at each other at top speed, hitting each other with all the force that you could, you know, imagine, getting blindsided, cutting, sprinting, jumping, flipping. I mean, it's an extreme event. Now, people would say, okay, well, they're athletes, they're healthy, they're strong. What is healthy about doing that? Nothing, right? That is 16 weeks or 18 weeks out of your year where you're basically just patch me up, put me back together, let me get on the field so I can go make millions of dollars. And a lot of people understand that. It's like, hey, I want to be healthy and fit, but I don't want to go step onto the football field on Sunday and get, you know, a defensive tackle coming and hitting me at full speed. Like, there's nothing healthy and fun about that. Well, you could kind of go all the way back to other sports that are maybe less contact related, and you can see that the pursuit of CrossFit at the highest level is not super healthy. You know, yeah, you might have some aerobic fitness and strength metrics that look healthy on paper, but the pursuit of it means draining mental and physical resources every single day, dedicating a tremendous amount of time to a sport in order to achieve a higher level of fitness, oftentimes feeling aches and pains, looking at athletes who have been in that sport for years and just looking at their joint health and realizing, wow, a lot of them are broken. A lot of them have had to have surgeries, knees, shoulders are all out of whack. And then, you know, looking at maybe blood metrics, blood chemistries on some of those athletes and seeing, oh, wow, look at, they're training so hard, their testosterone is in the tank. Many of them don't have any libido. They don't have sex because they're just so tired, and they're putting all of their recovery resources towards the fitness, and they don't have anything left in their bodies to try and, you know, have a intimate, you know, a physical, you know, connection with their partner. So is that healthy? Is that what people are chasing? Not the general population. They don't want that. They want to have vitality. They want to wake up, feel like they can bounce out of their bed and they're energetic and they can do any activity that comes their way. And, you know, they have good appetite control and they don't have to think about training all day, every day. That's what people are chasing. But in the CrossFit community, when I was a part of it, that line got super blurred. The whole methodology was very sound in its founding principles, but then the sport started to then define the methodology after years. And people looked at the sport, which was very appealing, and is, you know, I mean, who doesn't want to root for these athletes? It's incredible to watch. But then what athletes are doing on the competition floor then becoming what people are striving for in their personal pursuit of health and fitness then started to complicate. Like, why do I feel so beat up all the time? Why am I always so tired? Why am I getting injured? Why is this taking so many hours a day? Why can't I get the muscle up? I need to put in more training hours to get the muscle up. Okay, now you're starting to pursue fitness as an athlete rather than pursuing fitness as somebody who's looking for the health and vitality benefits of it, you know, to impact their lives positively. And when I, you know, for me, it's like I beat my head against the wall for years trying to help people recover from training CrossFit like they were athletes, when in reality, they were not athletes and they didn't really want to be athletes in the sport. But they got fed a bill of, you know, all kinds of, you know, not lies, but misinformation from myself and other coaches in the industry, which was like, oh yeah, if you're going to be good at this thing, or if you want to get the best benefit from it, you got to pursue it like an athlete. And you know, if you could just change the language on that and put it in the context of NFL football, it's like, oh yeah, you know, if you want to be really like healthy and strong, like you got to train and you got to go out and like play a football game every Sunday and get beat upside the head and do the whole deal. Like, people would be like, you're crazy. Why would I do that? But because fitness, CrossFit was fitness and the sport of CrossFit sounded like the sport of fitness. And it's like, well, they're just doing exercise. It must be healthy. And it's like, well, too much of anything is not healthy, right? And certainly the threshold for that in fitness is lower than, you know, in some other healthy behaviors that become unhealthy. So I don't know. Help me. Was that clear? Did that make sense? And did I kind of indirectly answer the question, or is there follow-up or more context that's needed?
No, sure. I mean, you did 100%, and you just told me and the audience what not to do. And maybe now you can continue a little bit about how a training should look when the goal is long-term health and fitness and not to be beat up. So what does a routine look like, which someone can, like, not easily, because easy is the wrong word, but can incorporate in order to look good, move well, have a good life?
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is like, there's a couple terms that are important, which are, I've learned through the bodybuilding community, because I think when we talk about bodybuilding and people that are doing bodybuilding for training, and I'm not talking about people that compete in the sport of bodybuilding, because competing in the sport of bodybuilding requires, you know, it may require taking, you know, PEDs, but, you know, really when you're competing in the sport, that means that you're going to take periods of time where you're going to go and prepare your body to step on stage and to showcase the muscle mass that you've built. And showcasing the muscle mass that you've built in bodybuilding is essentially a nutrition diet preparation. You diet extremely hard in order to get very lean so that people can see all the muscle you've worked hard for. But the training for bodybuilding, the year-round training for bodybuilding, is a relatively, I don't want to say this and offend anybody, but it's a much more simple concept than CrossFit, because there's fewer inputs. You're doing resistance training. That's almost exclusively what you're doing. There might be some cardio that you do, but it's very simple, steady state stuff. Where with CrossFit, it's like you're doing resistance training, Olympic lifting, powerlifting, gymnastics, skill work, Metcons, you know, long endurance. Like, you're doing all kinds of things. So it's very, like, complicated to, like, well, what does it take to become a good CrossFitter? I think the verdict's still out there. There's lots of different methodologies, but what does it take to be a good bodybuilder? It's like, you got to lift weight, you got to move your body against resistance hard, and that's kind of it, you know, and you got to do it consistently for a long time. Now, in the bodybuilding community, they talk about terms like minimal effective, you know, the minimal effective dose or the maximum recoverable volume. These are two terms that help us to understand what I'm going to try and say. What is the maximum recoverable volume? What's the maximum amount of work you can do and still recover? That is a number, or that is a threshold, a limit that you really want to understand very well as an athlete, if you're trying to be the biggest, most muscular person or the best CrossFitter, right? If you're going to be the best CrossFitter in the world, you are constantly going to flirt with that line of what is the maximum amount of work that I can do, both volume and intensity, and still recover so I can come back the next day and do it again and again and again and again and again. Because unless you're doing the maximum, you're not optimizing your chance at becoming the best athlete in the world. But if you're an everyday fitness person, you do not need to get anywhere near the maximum recoverable volume. What you need to be focused on is what is the minimal effective dose that I need to see change. Because if you're at the minimum effective dose to see change, you're going to, one, and you stay above that, you're going to be getting better. You're going to see your body composition improve. You're going to be adding strength. You're going to be adding muscle. You're going to be feeling cognitively, you know, more sharp. You're going to have better energy, and your mood is going to be elevated, and your hormones are going to be improved. Like, all the things that come from training are going to improve. Are they going to improve as fast as this person over here? No, but they're going to improve, and that's what people are looking for, is growth and a feeling of, like, I'm getting better. The benefit, though, of being down on this end of this scale is that if you're at minimum effective dose, you feel great. You're not close to overtraining. You're not close to burnout. You're not feeling aches and pains like you are every day that you are flirting with this line up here. If you drive your car the speed limit and you make sure to fill it up with, it, you know, get its oil changed on a regular basis and, you know, rotate the tires every few, you know, once a year or whatever. Like if you just do the minimum, your car's going to run for a long, long time. If you take your car and race it like a Formula One car and you push it all the time and you're hugging the turns and you're speeding around, you know, every single curve on the road, doesn't matter what fuel you're putting in your car. It doesn't matter how often you're getting your tires changed. Like you're just putting a lot of wear and tear on that car. That car's not going to last as long as the car that is just kind of cruising the speed limit every day. And so that's kind of where people make this mistake. They're being pushed by the marketing system and the fitness system to say, you got to do more, you got to do more, you got to be up here. CrossFit in its heyday and the people that were training were like focused on what is the maximum I can do to see results versus what's the minimum I need to do to see results. And let me just keep doing that every day for a long time. So I kind of cautioned against getting sucked into this over here. And the minimum effective dose for a lot of people, for every single person is different. You have to determine what that is for you. If you just got off the couch and you literally have not worked out for 2 years, then your minimal effective dose is dramatically less than the maximum, you know, recoverable volume side of the equation. It could simply look like go for a 30-minute walk a day, and then three times a week do a body weight full body, you know, kind of strength calisthenics workout. 30 minutes in your garage, and you would start seeing results. You know, the minimum effective dose for somebody who's off the couch is trade the bag of chips for a baked potato every day. Not go keto, not go like Whole 30, not do like the full transformation diet. Just literally take the bag of chips away and put in a baked potato instead. That could move the needle dramatically for that person. Right? Without having them feel like, oh my gosh, I'm deprived. I can't sustain this. I feel like I'm starving all the time. Like, so again, I'm still laying a lot of philosophy here, but what I'm trying to really anchor home for people is this concept and understanding that if we could orient more people towards the minimum effective dose when it comes to fitness, we would see less problems, we would see more incremental success, and likely a lot more consistency over periods of time. And with training, you know, that's what I kind of said. It's like, or movement, it's daily movement. There has to be a daily movement practice that is at your minimum effective dose within that. And that's walking, or that's, you know, It's something where you're moving for more hours than people think they need to in a given day. Like if you're awake for 17 hours or 18 hours and you sleep 6 hours, or if you're awake for 16 hours and you sleep 8 hours, is it unreasonable to think if you have 16 hours in a day, 2 of those hours you should be active? Maybe that's 15 minutes of a walk in the morning, 15 minutes at lunch, 15 minutes in the evening. That's 45 minutes plus a 75 minute, you know, dedicated period of time where you go for a bike ride or you go for a jog or you're in the gym. I know people think it's crazy, but it's like, that's 2 hours of your 16. Can you dedicate that to movement? All right, well, maybe let's just start with 90 minutes. All right. 45 minutes of walking spread out throughout the day and 45 minutes of like, I put the phone down, I close the laptop, I get out of my desk and I go and move for 45 minutes consistently. Maybe it's strength training, whatever. Like, how do you do that? You know, and is that unreasonable? I don't believe it is unreasonable. You know, and perhaps you live in a city where commuting is by foot or by bike and you have 45 minutes of commuting built into your day already. Beautiful. That's terrific. Unfortunately, a lot of people in America don't live in those environments. They don't live in cities like that. They commute everywhere by car, or they work from home and they don't commute anywhere. And so now they have to manufacture more movement. But that is minimum effective dose. And then additionally, minimum effective dose from a resistance training standpoint, muscle is the most important organ in your body. It is more, it's highly correlated to all health outcomes. More muscle you have, the better outcomes you have when it comes to cardiovascular disease, diabetes, obesity, you know, neurodegenerative disease. So muscle is profoundly important, as is cardiovascular fitness. But I would say first and foremost, being strong and having muscle mass is critical. So that would be the next layer of any minimal effective dose training strategy that I would say is important for people to focus on. And what's interesting is that because of, you know, the CrossFit movement made training intensely very attractive, sexy, and fun for people, and accessible. One of the best ways it got people to train intensely was through the Metcon. People were able to, without much training experience, come in with very light weights with these combinations of movements, express huge amounts of power, and experience intensity for the first time in training like they'd never experienced before. So that became this thing that people were really gravitating towards and they wanted more of. And so you started to see conditioning workouts, Metcons, fill more of people's gym time than the foundational resistance training that was probably the intent of CrossFit early on, was to get people to build a foundation of strength. And I think even if you look at like the pyramid of like, you know, CrossFit fitness and some of like the early journals, it was like, learn your body weight mechanics and gymnastics, then get strong, and then do, you know, conditioning, like hard, intense power output conditioning at the top. Like that was not meant to be the base of the pyramid of your fitness, but it became the base of the pyramid of many people's fitness in the CrossFit community. At least that's what they were attracted to. So when it comes to building muscle mass, the best way to build muscle mass and the best way to support that organ of longevity is through weight training, not through Metcons. It's to be doing more resistance training, strength training, bodybuilding type training. This is the method that has for decades and for centuries been the best way to build muscle tissue. The most muscular people on the planet employ that as a strategy. And the most muscular people in CrossFit that you see at competition, they're more muscular than the other people because they do more of the weight training. They do a lot more of the weight training than the typical person who engages in, you know, 4 to 5 Metcons a week. So that is the next tier of minimal effective dose, is to make sure you're doing resistance training, bodybuilding, that kind of lifting for 3 to 4 times a week, covering your whole body head to toe, lifting each muscle through a full range, or each joint through a full range of motion, targeting every muscle of your body with resistance training and making it hard, hard enough that your body's like, I must adapt, change, and get stronger. And this is something that is very difficult for people to understand who have not ever done it. How hard should I be lifting? Isn't it risky to lift weights heavy? All of that stuff creates fear and makes people miss the mark on that. And then above that, the next minimal effective dose is to incorporate some cardiovascular training at a moderate to high intensity, you know, slightly above what walking is for most people. Now, is that essential for everybody? I don't believe it is essential. Does it improve health metrics and health outcomes? Yes. But if you nail the walking and the daily movement and you nail the resistance training, then most people are going to see all the gains that they want to experience.
So what does the minimum effective dose for nutrition look like? I mean, you just said it a few minutes ago, change the chips with the baked potato. That's probably a good start. Or yeah, just drink water instead of soda. But what would you say is a balanced diet, and how can someone who's like just starting to make some changes, what are like the big levers they can use to make this minimum effective dose?
If somebody is, one thing that we know for sure is that humans eat until they're full. Like everybody eats until they're full. That's, and maybe not at every single meal, but over the course of weeks and months, people eat until their body perceives them being full and satiated. Now, the thing that signals to the brain, or the various signals to the brain that I am full, are both mechanical and chemical in our bodies. So if you take your stomach, which has a volume of about 6 cups, or I think it's 100 or 1500 milliliters, if you fill up your stomach till it's got 1500 milliliters of either food or fluid volume in it, then your brain gets it starts to stretch the stomach, which changes mechanical receptors that tells the brain, hey, I'm full. My stomach is full. Everybody has been able to expand their stomach and eat more than that and stuff themselves, at which point they feel kind of gross and like, oh my God, I'm like overly stuffed. I don't want to even look at food, right? So you can, that's because you filled up that vessel. There are also chemical signals once you start digesting food that hormones get released that say, okay, we've got food, release this hormone. And that when that hormone kind of washes over your brain's like, I don't need anything to eat right now. And we're going to keep doing, people are going to keep eating until they get those signals. Can you get, what's the fastest way to, what is the lowest calorie way to get to that signal? That's kind of what we want to teach people how to eat. We want to teach people what is the way you can achieve that signal to your brain, because you are going to seek out that signal when you have an abundance of food around. When there's food everywhere within, you know, at any given moment, the vast majority of people living in Western culture, there is food within, like, I don't know, 20 steps of where they're sitting, an abundance of calories to fill them up for days. Okay. If there's food that is that available and your brain has a sense of hunger because it's not fully satiated, then your body has chemical signals that are going to drive you to go and seek out food. That's just how we're built and how we've evolved. So if we're going to try and navigate the modern day food society, then we have to understand, how do we get ourselves to feel full without a massive amount of calories? That's what's going to keep people at a healthy body weight. And when they're at a healthy body weight, it changes all of their health metrics that they care about. So the minimum effective dose around nutrition is, how do we pull the lever of satiety the most effectively with the fewest amount of total calories? All right, that's the philosophy. The implementation, which people have heard, because they're going to hear me say the implementation, they're going to be like, oh, I've heard that before. But now with that context, what gets you full with less calories and the right nutrients to help your muscles grow, which I already said was the most important organ of longevity? It's protein and it's fiber, or high volume foods that have a lot of volume. They're big with fewer calories. And that's generally where you see fiber-rich foods and protein. So how do we get that into somebody's diet? We get them to eat 1 gram of protein per pound, or 2.2 kgs, or excuse me, how does that work? Yeah. For every grams per kg. Thank you. That was the conversion that I was looking for. All right. So we get them to eat that amount of protein daily. We get them to eat that amount of protein daily, spread out amongst their meals as evenly as possible. But I go a step further and I say, actually, I don't care if you get it spread out evenly at all your meals. I care that the first and the last meal of your day have a giant bolus of protein. So for most individuals, if you get 50 grams of protein for breakfast and 50 grams of protein for dinner, you're at least 50% of the way, if not more, towards your goal of protein per day. And that should be an absolute, you know, staple that's going to help you feel more full and satiated throughout all of your waking hours. Now, if on top of that, every meal, you make the next thing that you put on your plate something that is high volume, high fiber, with not a lot of calories, that generally goes together, then you suddenly get protein, which fills you up, and then you get volume of food that fills you up, and you've kept your calories low. And now that's what you've done for three meals a day. Plus, you understand how to carry with you high protein snacks that are low calorie. Dude, you are set. You're set in so many ways. You're going to be getting the nutrients you need. You're going to be getting the protein you need for your muscles to be as healthy and as robust as they possibly can be. You're going to mitigate the issue of abundance of calories all around you that you're going to want to eat. You're going to be ahead of, you're going to be proactively curbing your cravings. It's protein, fiber-rich foods, and adequate hydration, drinking enough water. The drug that is popular, the class of drugs, semiglutides, Ozempic, is very, very heavily prescribed for weight loss. This is a drug that helps curb people's appetite by making their stomachs release food slower. So it keeps their stomachs full longer. It's basically the drug that is doing what I'm saying we need to do, which is win the satiety game. It is the most effective weight loss drug that has ever really been produced and put on the mass market. And it has helped a lot of people reverse diabetes, reverse obesity, lose weight. Does everybody need to go on Ozempic? No. It's worked for a lot of people, but I'm bringing it up because the mechanism is what I'm talking about here. What is a meal that would actually feel like taking Ozempic? It would be eight to 10 ounce chicken breast. That's a lean, not a lot of fat, super high in protein. Plus, on the plate, like an equal size, if not maybe double the size of that chicken breast, serving of asparagus or serving of Brussels sprouts or serving of, you know, a vegetable. Asparagus has a lot of fiber and it's very slow to digest, as is the chicken breast. If you ate chicken breast and asparagus, and then with that you drank about 12 to 16 ounces of water or whatever the equivalent is in liters, and you did that three times a day, you would be like, oh my God, I'm so full. Like, I don't know if I can eat anymore. Like, you essentially mimic being on Ozempic. Now, I'm not saying that everyone wants to live off of chicken breast and asparagus for the rest of their life, but you can build a food list of maybe 10 different proteins and probably 10 to 15 different vegetable, fruit, or carbohydrate sources that are high fiber and very satiating. You can build that list and then basically just build meals out of that every day. And if you're doing it proactively and you have a plan in place and that's your minimum effective dose, like, you'll never have to count a carb. You'll never have to count a gram of fat. You likely won't even have to look at calorie counts on anything. You just need to focus on those two things and you will simplify your recipe for dieting success.
So when you say that, it sounds pretty easy, and still a lot of people, they don't really get it and they don't know how to start, and when I talk to people when they first come into the CrossFit box, their primary goal is to get moving, and that's what I tell them. No, start with one thing and we'll fix the nutrition later on. But I feel like a lot of people, they don't have the problem with coming to the gym on a regular basis, but they never really get their nutrition wrong. So what do you think are the biggest pitfalls why the people can't implement those basic and I think easy principles?
It's a product of a number of things. I mean, I think, well, there's two topics that I'll cover. The first topic is going to be about diet culture and how diet culture has steered people the wrong way, got them focused on the wrong thing. And the second is the modern day psychological health, mental health crisis. All right. So I'll start with the, let's start with the mental health crisis. A lot of people are struggling and suffering silently with their emotional and psychological states. There's a pain, there's a loneliness, there is a disconnect from purpose, that many people feel. And there's a disconnect with their bodies. There's a disconnect from their physiology. There's a lack of awareness on how their environment, their relationships, their work, all these things make them feel. And when people feel, and the felt experience in their life is like suboptimal, like I don't feel great. I don't feel good about myself. I don't feel good about my life situation. Then they want to turn towards what can I do to change my state, my physiology right now so that I feel better? And food and alcohol and substances are just a very powerful tool to get somebody back into feeling something in their body that feels good. It's pleasurable, right? We have, you know, thousands and thousands of years of evolution, hundreds of thousands of years of evolution to make tasting food and sugar be this incredibly rewarding experience, because we want our bodies to experience that, be like, that was really good, so good that I'm going to climb over this, you know, mountain on no food for 3 days to go and seek out the next meal like that, right? Like it's powerful. It's a powerful driver of reward. And we have it so available to us so that people can go in a modern culture where there's a lot of emptiness that people feel. Okay, I'm going to go and fill that with, food or alcohol or substances, drugs. So if mental health was like substantially better for people and they felt complete, they felt safe, they felt secure, they felt loved, they felt connected every day, there would be much less need to go out and overindulge in food regularly. I think anybody listening can think to a time in their life where they were excited, they were purposeful and passionate, they woke up each day with meaning, they felt like they were in a brand new relationship where they like were just in love and the person loved them and they just felt good every day. Like, and then think back to like your eating habits and how your body felt and looked at those times. It was like, oh, you probably looked and felt like your best. And then you could think about a time in your life where things were shit and they were going terribly. You were in a bad relationship. You hated your job. You hated like when things were the worst, like, okay, how is your body then? How is your relationship to food? Probably pretty bad. And so that's just sort of like, okay, why can't people do the thing that seems so simple? So, I mean, the fix for that is, okay, well, we got to focus on mental and emotional health for a lot of people and give them tools to learn how to sit with those hard feelings and overcome them that don't revolve around using food and substance and alcohol to basically like cover it up momentarily. And then I said the other thing was diet culture. And diet culture has led people astray in another way. This is the culture, the dieting culture is one that took a concept and a principle and sort of made it this like pervasive theme of like how you become, lose weight or how you manage your weight. Now, the principle is this law of like thermodynamics, this calories in, calories out concept, energy balance. If you eat this much and you burn this much, then you gain weight. If you eat less, but you burn more, then you lose weight. And if you eat the same as what you burn, you maintain weight. Okay, it's a very simple and valid question principle. But because we know that eating less and moving more is the recipe, then that has become just this hyper-focus in diet culture. How do we get you to eat less? Eat less. Eat less. 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 You know, it's just like, it's so deeply ingrained that it has manifested as behaviors that do not help you eat less and move more over the long term. It's manifested in behaviors that help you eat less in micro moments throughout your day, but they set you up for failure over time. And now let me get to like the real example that most people fail at. It is, I woke up today, I got this surge of adrenaline and cortisol going on because it's the beginning of the day. I just slammed a couple cups of coffee, got some caffeine going. I'm feeling wired. And you know what? I'm feeling really disciplined. I'm going to eat a tiny breakfast. I'm going to skip breakfast today. Boom. I'm winning. I just had I had one egg and two cups of coffee, and I don't need to eat lunch until noon or 1 o'clock. Good for me because I'm winning according to diet culture. And then I got to lunch and I'm still kind of vibing. I'm still kind of going. I'm still on a little bit of my morning high. Maybe I had a second cup of coffee at 11 o'clock, you know, and now it's only one and I'm still kind of, my appetite is suppressed from my coffee. I'm going to have like a small, sensible lunch. I'm going to have like a little salad with a little bit of chicken on it. Okay, great. I'm winning again. Look, I didn't have that many calories. Awesome. And then 3 o'clock rolls around and 4 o'clock rolls around and you haven't eaten much. You're not satiated. All the cortisol and the adrenaline and the caffeine has kind of worn off. You're tired and you're ravenous. And now you have to figure out how between that point of the day and when you go to bed, you're not going to sabotage your whole calorie situation. And if you're early on in a diet, or you're early on in your motivation, it's only the second day of the new year, you find a way to power through it. Maybe you have another cup of coffee in the afternoon to kind of like ride it out. You have a sensible dinner. You go to bed, try and rinse and repeat the next day. Eventually that catches up to you and you can't sustain it anymore. The first place to go is it's Thursday night or Friday night and you go out with some friends and you really have had a low calorie week. But you get a couple drinks in you because you're trying to be social. You eat, you know, not only your daily share, but you go well over your daily share of calories. You're super, super full because you kind of, in essence, binged on whatever the meal was that night. Maybe you get home and you're like, oh, you know, I've been so good this week. You have a couple, you know, a whole bar of chocolate, whatever. You go way over your calories. The next day, you're like, shit, I didn't do well. Last night I overdid it. So I'm back on I'm going to eat nothing for breakfast. I'm going to eat a tiny lunch. Boom. The next night, do it again. Binge. And by days, you know, after 2 days of that, you've totally wiped out your calorie deficit. And because on all of those days, you were eating such minimal protein and minimal food in the early part of your days, your muscle mass is suffering because you haven't been eating adequate protein every day. And so this is where like diet culture says, I got to eat less. And most people are trying to eat less, eat less, eat less. And they're sabotaging getting adequate amounts of protein at even intervals. And remember, I said getting protein to start your day and to end your day is critical for maintaining and building that organ of longevity, which is your muscle. And people are not getting it done. And they, what has felt for, let's say they did this yo-yo or this like up and down process for a month. They're like, man, I've been starving myself and cutting calories every morning or every day. And here I haven't lost any weight. It's because they've overindulged on those additional days of the week, which have led them to basically not be in any type of deficit. And so they end out at the end of the month, they're like, well, the whole calorie cutting doesn't work. And they're like, just screw it. And they just kind of go back to not even paying any attention, having any awareness. Now they're feeling down. It's compounded their emotional and mental health crisis that they're in. And they go back to, you know, basically just winging it with their food and eating to kind of quell their emotional distress. And they feel terrible and they start to gain weight again. And so that's, again, two sides of the equation there as to why there's such a challenge. And that's why I'm really like, you know, big on what we're doing right now, which is like a 50 gram protein challenge. It's like every day before 10 a.m., get 50 grams of protein in for breakfast and then have a big protein dinner. And then here's some strategies on how to, you know, meal prep lunch and take high protein snacks with you. And that right there, along with those fiber rich foods on your plate every meal, that could be a huge unlock for people where they wake up and they have a big breakfast, but it's the right type of breakfast that's going to help them mitigate or manage calories for the rest of their day and get their muscles to actually be more robust and healthy and strong.
You summed it up very well. I think in the end, it requires a little bit of discipline with the sports and with the nutrition as well, but in the end, you have to follow some basic principles that when you do them on a regular basis can get you where you want to be, which is healthy and feeling good, looking good without throwing your body against the wall. And I think that's probably the thing that most people don't understand is that it doesn't have to be very complicated. You just have to find something that's good for you and then just do it for months, for years, and make it a lifestyle and not just a quick diet or, oh, the start of the new year, I'm going to the gym for 3 months and then I just skip it. And I think when people like you or me, when we share this kind of knowledge and we spread the word, that hopefully some people have it easier to start with some new routines, especially now at the end of the year. Maybe they don't wait for the new year, they start next week. And I think that's probably the coolest things as coaches, to see when people really make changes with the things we give them. And yeah, that's just my two cents.
No, I agree. And I talk a lot, and like, it's important for me to talk with some certainty around certain subjects. Like, hey, I know that this is what is happening and this can work. And that's not to say that it should be easy for anybody to do themselves, or that it's going to, you know, magically make the whole process work for the first time and it's never worked before. So I cannot underplay, I mean, I can't overstate the importance of the psychological and emotional aspect of this thing. And, you know, one thing to help people at this time of year before they head into the new year is, not that you're going to like figure out your mental and emotional health state perfectly for any, you know, any long period of time going forward. But one place you can focus some energy on is before you decide to incorporate some new strategy for health and wellness, I would highly encourage you to spend time really understanding why you want to do this in the first place. You know, developing a very powerful reason why behind any of the changes you're going to make is so important. You know, I've seen this in my own family. I've seen this in friends and clients. You know, it's they tried for so long to do something, and then something changed in their life. Maybe it's a circumstance. Maybe it was they got a blood test that showed, hey, you actually, this, there's this, you have this like high risk marker for metabolic disease or your cholesterol is quite high. And they're like, oh my gosh, like I thought I was doing pretty good, but I just realized how important my health is and I need to make this change. And then suddenly they get on a more consistent path with their nutrition and a month goes by and 2 months goes by and they've lost 7 or 8 and 9 pounds and they've never been able to do that in the past, but they had a very big wake up call or they got really connected to like, this is the why behind it. And if you feel like, oh, that, I have a good reason to do this, but you really spend some time with it, you're like, actually, it's not that strong and compelling a reason to do this, then it's not going to hold up when things get challenging and difficult, which changing your lifestyle is always going to be challenging and difficult. It just is. So, you know, spend this last month of 2023 really trying to get clarity and like a vision of like, this is what I want to change and this is why I want to change it. And like that why I want to change it is so compelling to me that I know it's going to make me do the hard thing when that hard thing, you know, comes up. And eventually that hard thing will become routine and it'll become part of your lifestyle. But you need something that's going to push you over the edge. And so like, you know, the athlete that's getting paid millions of dollars to show up and do the thing, like they're very, very motivated to do that thing well. And it's going to force them and have them doing it, you know, better than most. The athlete that believes it is their purpose and their drive and their passion, their reason for living to be the best on the world and to set, you know, like the Michael Jordan mentality of like, I am going to be the best basketball player that there ever was. And I'm going to raise the bar and it is my destiny to do so. Like that's more motivating than all the money that you could have ever paid him at any given time in his career. He was so compelled to do it that he was going to work harder than anybody had ever worked to be the best basketball player there ever was. So, you know, find a good reason, find an even better reason, and find the reason that will make you never, you know, go to sleep on what you need to be doing to be better, you know, and any one of those levels can be a valuable tool to spend time thinking about as you head into, you know, the new year.
Marcus, it was a pleasure talking to you. And I think I learned something. I think the listeners, they learned something. And it's always cool to hear perspectives from different people about the topics that I really like and their sport and nutrition and lifestyle. And I think our passion for this is what is driving us. This is our why we create the content that we do in order to make changes in people. And yeah, it was really cool to have you here again on the show.
Well, thanks for having me back, Felix. And I hope people did get something from it. And if they want to follow up with me or they have more questions, they can always find me on Instagram at Marcus Philly. And you can send me a DM and I'd be happy to engage with you over messages.
I'll put the links in the show notes and I wish you a very nice start of the day.
Thank you.